Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program that introduces to WFIU listeners interesting people from Indiana, the United States, and around the world. I'm Owen Johnson. On this occasion, we welcome Andrea Koppel, an award-winning, internationally renowned journalist who for more than two decades was practicing her craft as a reporter and more recently has become involved in public relations. Andrea, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you so much, Owen.
Obviously, anytime you mention the name Andrea Koppel, people say, the daughter of Ted Koppel. If they don't know, they say, is that the daughter of Ted Koppel? When did you first realize your dad was famous?
I don't know, to be honest with you. I remember sitting around the dining room table, actually the kitchen table, where there was a television, and we'd eat dinner, and around 6:30 in the evening, we'd have the television tuned to ABC News, and I can tell you, this gives you a sense as to just how young I was. One point, my mother was cooking, and we were sitting at the table, and actually Sesame Street was on before we had turned to ABC, and we said, Daddy, Daddy. And my mother said, kids, Daddy's not on Sesame Street. And we kept, Daddy, Daddy, sure enough, came over, and apparently ABC had sold some clips to Sesame Street for the number two, and maybe for other things as well. And my father had done a story many years before on dance lessons at whatever that famous dance studio is in New York. And he was dancing with a Latina woman, a tango. And sure enough, Daddy was on Sesame Street. But for us, it wasn't, you know, it was like, oh, there's Daddy on TV. So I think probably I realized that he was famous probably in high school and then much more so in college because I started college in the early 1980s, and that's when Nightline was really starting to take off.
Were there disadvantages to having a famous father?
Yes, I would say so. And I think on a couple of different levels. I should preface all of this, Owen, and say that I'm tremendously proud of being Ted Koppel's daughter and having a mentor like him, somebody who I've had an opportunity to turn to at many points during my career for counsel. But I would say that the challenges of being Ted Koppel's daughter involve just, you know, anytime I started a new job or worked in a new bureau or met people in the industry, they either assumed that I thought very highly of myself because I was Ted Koppel's daughter. They watched me much more closely because I was Ted Koppel's daughter. If I had been Andrea Pollock, let's say, which is actually my married name instead of Andrea Koppel, I think perhaps things might have been a little bit different at different points in my career. I also think, personally speaking, it is, and this is now as a woman who's in her 40s, looking back on a woman who was in her 20s and 30s in this profession, I now recognize no matter what I did, it was always going to seem good, but my father is an icon. It's hard to compete with an icon. And my father and I, ironically, actually had very similar careers in that he's the one who urged me to go into radio, and I worked for a member station of NPR many years ago. That was my first job in the business. And then I went into television, and I went overseas, which is what my father had done. And I was the Beijing bureau chief. My father was the Hong Kong bureau chief. Then I came back to the States, and I became the State Department correspondent, the diplomatic correspondent for CNN. My father had been the diplomatic correspondent for ABC. What's the next step after that? Well, the next step for my father was Nightline. It's kind of hard, you know. There are only a couple of jobs out there like that. And also, I think, personally speaking, I think there are gender issues, there are generational issues, which made my choice. You mentioned that I'm no longer a journalist. I'm now in public affairs, public relations, that made my decision a more natural one, and that is to leave the industry than for my father, who was the breadwinner in our family. And he decided, and quite honestly, I think in my family, we believe my father had a calling and still has a calling. It's something that so encompasses the man that he could never retire. He could never leave journalism because journalism is so who he is and it's his mission. For me, I have a four-year-old child, and when I left CNN, he was 3 and a half, and I almost never saw my son. And I decided, you know what? In the grand scheme of things, if I can't find a job in journalism that interests me enough, that taps into the experience that I have, and I, with all due respect to some fantastic local news reporters out there, I had been a local news reporter. I didn't see myself going back into local news. I had covered international affairs. I'd covered domestic politics. I needed a beat. And you can't be a part-time beat person. You really can't. You need to be doing it 5 days, 6 days a week. So I thought, what makes the most sense for somebody with my skill set and my priorities, my personal priorities? And so that's where I chose public affairs.
Somewhere I read that at one time you had thought about being a veterinarian. Was there anything else you thought about as a career, as a contrast to a journalist parent?
No. And do you know why I decided not to be a veterinarian?
No.
Because I realized, I guess by the time I was a junior in high school, that you needed to be really good in math and science. And while I was an okay student, I had B's, I wasn't an A student. I thought, do I really want to torture myself for 8 years through college and medical school to become a veterinarian? And I thought, you know, I'm going to choose the path of least resistance. And quite honestly, when I graduated from high school, had no intention. When I graduated from college, had no intention of becoming a journalist. Even though it was what I was drawn to naturally, I was in working on my high school newspaper. I was the news director by the time I graduated from college of our high school, of our college radio station. But that was what I did for extracurricular activity. That's not what I did for a job. And I was determined to prove all of those people out there who thought that because I was Ted Koppel's daughter, I was going to become a journalist. So what did I do 6 months or a year after I graduated? I became a journalist.
But as an undergraduate, you may not have done math and science, but you did Chinese. Why Chinese? I know and your major was political science, but Chinese was a significant minor.
Well, I studied Chinese because I love languages. I am good at languages, and I had studied French in high school, and I studied a little bit in college. And quite honestly, now that I think back on it, to answer your earlier question, I was thinking about perhaps going into the Foreign Service. So I had decided I wasn't going to be a veterinarian. When I was in college, I was thinking, well, maybe I'll try the Foreign Service. I like international affairs. I like living overseas. Perhaps that's the right path for me. And I thought, well, if I spoke a more difficult language, something other than a romance language, maybe I'd have a leg up on the competition. And it was a natural choice for me to study Chinese because I had lived in Hong Kong as a kid while my dad covered the Vietnam War. So Asia was something that felt very familiar to me. And when we were talking, I was talking to my parents, getting their advice about which language do I study, Japanese, do I study Chinese, maybe even Russian. Their advice was, look, Russia, which is the language that so many Americans had been studying at that point, Russia is the language of the 20th century. Chinese will be the language of the 21st century. Seems to make a lot of sense at this point. But really, you know, in the 1980s, 25 years ago, there weren't a lot of people studying Chinese. I mean, we were still a pretty small group at Middlebury College, which is one of the best language schools in the country. And even there, it wasn't a large class, 30 kids studying it. Now I know there are some magnet schools that are teaching Chinese in Oregon, to beginning in kindergarten. Public schools and kids go all the way through high school, which is just fantastic.
Now, even with Middlebury's reputation for Chinese, when you first went to Beijing and you went as a translator and interpreter, did you feel confident that you knew Chinese well enough to get along?
I think I was ignorant of what I didn't know. I spoke very solid Chinese if you are in a restaurant. and you want somebody to pass the salt or, you know, I'd like a little more, please. We were able to speak, and I talk about myself and my classmates, very good basic Chinese. And when I went, it was actually, even though I was effectively a translator, the job title was U.S. Trade Representative, which is a fancy title. We were actually trying to help American businessmen get business in China, and we were basically middlemen, actually middle women, because everyone in the company, with the exception of one guy who worked part-time, were women. And that was the draw for our company. Virginia Kamsky only hired young women who spoke Chinese, and guess what? All of our clients were a bunch of older men. Surprise, surprise. Once I got to China and in 1985 and started traveling around the country and getting into all different situations, I did recognize at that point, oh, I think I need to go back to the books, got to study some more.
That must have been about the same time you decided, this career isn't turning out as I expected.
You know, I went to China because, and I'll save you all of the gory details, but when I graduated from Middlebury, I had decided at that point, no, I wouldn't go into the Foreign Service. I was going to go into the Peace Corps. I was going to go to Nepal. We ended up hearing through a family friend that there had been a number of rapes of Peace Corps women in Nepal around the same time. I checked with the Washington office of the Peace Corps. They confirmed it. That was about all my parents needed to hear to say, you're not going. So there I was. It was September of 1985. I had no job. I had no idea what I wanted to do. And a family friend, another family friend from China, was passing through town. He said, you know, there's a woman named Virginia Kamsky who's looking to hire young women who speak Chinese. Are you interested? And I thought, am I interested? I wasn't interested in business. I had no idea what I was interested in, but it was a job and it sounded exciting. I was 21 years old and it was an opportunity to go to the country that I had studied, you know. So I went to China, did the job, realized it was not my cup of tea. But while I was in China and I was thousands upon thousands of miles away from my father's shadow and people in China had not heard of my father, I think it was while I was there, I was able to kind of let down my guard and really listen. Most of my friends were journalists, and we would get together. I was only there for 6 months, but I was there for sort of all the major holidays. And we would get together, a big group of us, and I was always the youngest. And I would listen to their stories, and I thought, my God, that sounds like a great profession. I guess I really do want to be a journalist after all. So I quit my job in the spring of 86, and I came back to the U.S. and started looking for a job and got this job in Columbia, South Carolina, working for WLTR Radio, member station of NPR.
Why start at a public radio station? Most people would say, aha, somebody who's been on TV, you start on TV.
Well, my father had started in radio. And it's a little more difficult than I hope. There are probably people out there who've had success going from zero to 60 and getting a job with no journalism experience in television. I didn't want to go and be a production assistant or some of the other kind of supporting roles of the team that helps put the piece on the air that the correspondent, the reporter fronts. I wanted to be a reporter. And at that stage in my life, that was the place that offered me the job to be a reporter. So the pay was about $11,700 a year, which if it wasn't below the poverty line, I think was darn close. And I did that job for 6 months and had a wonderful time. Probably would have stayed in Columbia for a lot longer had it not been the fact that I was really just getting by on the paycheck that I had and ended up finagling a free trip on Amtrak. I told them, I'm going to do a story about train travel between, the South and the North. So for whatever, they bought it. I got to do my story and I got a free trip back to D.C. And while I was there, I had applied to WTOP Radio, which is the all-news radio station in the D.C. area. And there was no job at that point. I think 2 weeks later, after I got back to Columbia, there was a message on my answering machine from the head guy at WTOP saying, "How'd you like to come up? I can't offer you a full-time job. This is a temporary 3-month deal, vacation relief for a woman who is going on maternity leave." And I thought, you know, it's a little risky. I could not have a job after 3 months. But, you know, when you're 22, 23 years old, you say, the heck with it. I'm going to try it. So I went back home, and the job at WTOP lasted 2 years. And while I was in D.C., while I was back there, you know, I would run across other reporters in the field, and I got to know a local TV reporter there, John Stephanopoulos. He was a very nice guy, and, you know, I was working all different shifts at the radio station, all different days, and more often than not, my days off were during the week. So I asked him if I could tag along on my, you know, on my days off 1 day a week, and I did that for a number of months. And I would carry the tripod and follow them around out there. And finally, I summoned the courage to say, you know, do you think I could perhaps shoot an on-camera stand-up? And right around that time, we were coming up on the 25th anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech and the march on the Washington Mall. And so I got to do my stand-up there. One of my friends was an editor. We edited the story together, and I used that story to apply to various television stations all over the place, and was lucky enough to get a job at a television station in Baltimore, Maryland, at WJZ-TV. And that's where I started. Those poor people who had to work with me had no idea how to put together a story. And I remember thinking, watching reporters in the field and thinking, they were so brilliant that they could think of how to end their story. You know, they do the on-camera before they had written it. How did they do that? How did they? You know, I had a lot to learn, and they were very, very patient and very gracious and supportive of me in Baltimore, and I spent 2 years there. And then the news director of the local TV station that I used to spend a lot of time at tagging along had been a fan of mine, and really I was a nice supporter, sort of rooting off field for me. And he got a job as the news director in Miami and called me up one day and said, "How'd you like to come down to Miami?" And the next thing I knew, I was working at WPLG-TV in Miami, Florida. And that, Owen, is where I got my first taste of being a foreign correspondent, because Miami is one of the most wonderful news markets that you can, if you're interested in international affairs, that you can work in, because you have such a rich community there. You have Latinos, you have Haitians, you have Jewish snowbirds who've come down there. So they're interested in what's happening in the Middle East and what's happening in Latin America and what's happening. They're really, so I got to go to Haiti a couple of times, and I got to go to Guantanamo, Cuba before Gitmo became the internment center of choice for many suspected terrorists. And I got bitten by the bug and said, this is what I have to do. I have to become a foreign correspondent.
Was there anything about wanting to get out of television news? Because there's that phrase, if we adapt it a little bit, what's a nice woman like you doing in local television news?
No. I think really what it was is that my interests, as wonderful as Miami was and as frequently as I got to file on international stories, it wasn't enough. It was still probably 20%, 15% of the time that I was there. And there are lots and lots of local reporters who spend their entire career reporting on their community. I enjoyed it, but I wanted more. I wanted to see the world. I wanted to report on the world. My interests were international in nature. And so I applied. I think I had applied to CNN when I was in Baltimore and didn't get a job. And while I was in Miami, I applied again. And as they say, timing is everything. Because when I applied while I was in Miami, they were beginning to look for a correspondent, a Chinese-speaking correspondent, to replace their longtime Beijing bureau chief, Mike Chinoy. So, wow, suddenly I show up And I'm convinced that had I not spoken Chinese, I would not have necessarily gotten the job. But I spoke Chinese, and they were looking, and the timing just worked out.
I'm trying to remember how this went. Did you start out as Beijing bureau chief, or were you based in Tokyo for a while?
I was based in Tokyo. They knew that Mike was going to want to take a leave of absence to write his memoirs, but he didn't know when. He knew it was going to be soon, maybe a couple years down the road, and that's in fact what happened. So CNN said, look, we can't tell you when, but you will be going to Beijing. In the interim, we'd like you to go to Tokyo as a correspondent. Now, I had no interest in going to Japan, but it was still exhilarating to be a foreign correspondent. And quite honestly, I am so glad it happened that way because I think I learned to view China in a much more sophisticated way, having reported from Japan, and then I also spent quite a bit of time in Korea and South Korea, and I was able to learn about China's neighbors, which I'm really grateful that I had the chance to do. And I also got to spend time in Japan, which is a very interesting place. I think the frustrating part of it for me is that I don't speak Japanese, and Japan is a difficult place to get around. I think many countries are, but certainly in Japan, a very difficult place to get around if you don't speak the language. It's a very difficult place to eat if you don't speak the language. Thank goodness for plastic food, which they usually display in restaurant windows, and that was how I managed to get by. But I really, really enjoyed living in Japan, and I remember because I spent quite a bit of time when Mike would go on his home leave or he'd have different assignments, they would fly me into Beijing and have me fill in for him. So I did that for 18 months. And I remember the contrast could not have been more stark to leave Japan where you could eat off the floors of the train station and you could set your watch to the trains and you could, you know, everything is so civilized and so polite. And you go to China where you got to watch yourself because some guy may, you know, hawk a loogie on your shoe. And, you know, everything is, there's no such thing really as personal space, you know. With 1.3 billion people, I guess when I lived there was 1.2, you don't have a lot of space in the cities, you know. You're dealing with, things don't run on time and the roads are what you might imagine a third world country's roads to be. And I loved every moment of it. I loved being in China. And I think for me, obviously, one of the things that made it such a thrilling experience was the fact that I did speak the language and I could go to all of those off the beaten track places. And I was able to see the country through the eyes of the locals. And I didn't have to rely on someone to guide me through. I mean, my Chinese was very good by the time I left China. I never conducted official interviews in Chinese. I had, fortunately, one of my colleagues who later replaced me as bureau chief, Rebecca McKinnon, speaks phenomenal Chinese, and she would do most of those interviews. She had actually lived in China and gone to school there as a kid. But having said that, I was able to experience China the way the locals did. And I remember just feeling like I was just being, you know, bounced through two of the most different countries that you can imagine, China and Japan, even though you might think both in Asia.
Both Confucian,
but first world, third world. Democracy, dictatorship.
I'd like to come back to this, but it's time to pause for some music. You've picked as your favorite, We Didn't Start the Fire by Billy Joel. Why that music?
Well, it is so rich with both pop culture, international affairs. If my interpretation of the song is that he's talking about sort of where we're a little bit, we don't have control over what's happening in the world. We didn't start the fire. And I love the creativity of the song and the idea that he packs it full of so many things that have happened over the last 40 years or 50 years. I never tire of listening to it.
That was We Didn't Start the Fire by Billy Joel, music chosen by our guest on Profiles today, Andrea Koppel. Andrea, why don't you tell us, I want to go back to your journalistic career, but tell us what you're doing now in this PR job.
Well, I just started at the beginning of February, and the company is called M&R Strategic Services, and I'm heading up their communications and media relations. This firm, you know, when I think back on why I wanted to become a journalist and what it was that made me feel so excited about the job, it was the idea that I could be a voice for the voiceless, the idea that you can cover issues that really help to raise awareness about what's happening in the world. And what M&R does, and you look at their roster of clients, everything from the Save Darfur Coalition to the Susan G. Komen Race for the Cure to Habitat for Humanity, these are all wonderful organizations trying to help a particular group of people. And as I mentioned earlier in the program, when I was trying to figure out what did I want to do that was going to give me a quality of life, tap into the skill set that I've been honing the last 20 years, it seemed like M&R was the right fit for me, because even though I've crossed over in the sense that I'm no longer, and I know there's probably listeners out there who would say, well, most journalists, we think, are not objective. I tried to be objective in my reporting. I really did. I feel like I've crossed over into the gray area as opposed to the dark side. I've crossed over into an area that is clearly advocacy, but who can argue with trying to stop a genocide? Who can argue with the need to build houses for people who don't have them, the need to try to bring food and medical care to children or people who are living in desperate conditions? So to me, these are the causes that really spoke to me. And I thought, gosh, if I can use my connections in the world of journalism, if I can help these people, because one of the things I'm going to do is try to tell their stories with video, if we can offer our clients the opportunity to put together really slick, and I don't mean slick in terms of Madison Avenue slick, but just well-produced television stories that maybe go on their website, perhaps are sent around on DVD to try to fundraise. If I can help them do that, my gosh, I'll be doing the work that initially drew me to journalism. And M&R has, in fact, recently we just had a company-wide retreat, which is the first one they've had. And this company's been around for 15 years, so I feel like the timing couldn't be better for me. So there are offices all across the country in Oregon and California and Washington State and New York. And I got to meet the 79 employees of M&R, and most of them come out of political campaigns and grassroots and grass tops, something, a term I had not used before, but grass tops kind of campaigning. And I find it fascinating. So I'm going to learn a lot and at the same time get to hopefully help the various organizations that I admire and respect.
In the 1990s, people used to talk about the CNN effect that could do the same thing, that CNN would carry a story on starvation in Africa and people would respond. Did you feel when you were with CNN that you had that kind of impact?
I did. And I would say that obviously the traditional media and organizations like CNN will certainly continue to be a market for our clients. I would say, unfortunately, that the business of broadcasting has changed, and it's changed for several reasons. It's changed because of remote controls. It's changed because there's just a proliferation of other programs to watch on hundreds of different channels. And it's changed because it has become, and certainly since CNN has been around, it is really a business. There are businessmen and women who run these companies with boards of directors and with shareholders whom they have to answer to. And so when you're under pressure, as the executives at CNN are, to continue to make more money than you did the year before, and you know that one of the ways that you make that money is when advertisers will pay premium dollars to a show that has a larger number of viewers among the 18 to 34 demographic, the type of news that you put on is going to be skewed to appeal to them. Now, I have to say, here at Indiana University, I have been really heartened talking with some of the young journalism students here who've said, why isn't there more hard news on CNN? Why are we seeing the Britney Spears and the Paris Hiltons and these kinds of stories? And I thought, my God, from your lips to the executives' ears, if only that message could get through, if only there were more young, bright, talented kids like this. I don't know. I don't know why they think those stories. Clearly, they've done market research. They've put a lot of money into trying to figure out what kinds of stories appeal to the CNN viewers. But I think that is why the CNN effect that existed really, you know, from the first Gulf War through much of the 90s, I think is not there as much. I think that there is still, when CNN puts stories on, my goodness, I think there is definitely a ripple. Is it a tsunami? You know, I don't think so. I think that when there is a major breaking news story that everyone is interested in watching, they do gravitate to CNN. But if it isn't such a big story, you know, you get 500,000 viewers, 400,000 viewers in a given show. My father's program, Nightline, used to have 11, 12, at really big story, 15 million people who would tune in to watch. So, you know, a fraction at CNN of what Nightline used to get. I don't know what the answer is.
I guess there's always been a tension between what the public is interested in and what's in the public interest. If you look at Edward R. Murrow in the 50s doing the interview program person to person, because that paid the bills so he could do See It Now.
Absolutely. And there's the lost leader idea that, you know, back in the 1960s, it was a public service to put on your evening newscast, the Huntley Brinkley. You would watch Walter Cronkite, whomever it was. News organizations did not expect at all to make money on those news programs. They were lost leaders. You didn't have remote controls. If you had your television set tuned to NBC or ABC to watch the evening news, chances are it stayed there because we were couch potatoes, right? We weren't going to get up. I mean, that was a big deal to get up and change your own television channel. But in 1968, something else happened. There was a news magazine show that made its debut on CBS called 60 Minutes. And before 60 Minutes, no news program had ever turned a profit, and it took a couple of years. But by the 70s, 60 Minutes was a moneymaker. And then you had executives at other networks going to their news department and saying, hey, come on, we want some of that green stuff too. And that was when the industry really began to look at the evening news in a different way.
I want to come back something to your reporting. After China, you went to the State Department. That's an interesting responsibility because, in a way, you inevitably become a spokesperson for U.S. government policy. Did you find that a problem?
When I started at the State Department, it was May of 1998, and in fact, I think it was either the day or a couple days after India tested a nuclear device, Pakistan tested a nuclear device, the Indonesian president Suharto was overthrown, and you know the proverbial you-know-what hit the fan. It just seemed like all over the world. And I felt personally that I was in over my head, really was. I didn't have anyone to turn to. I mean, obviously, as I said, I had my father, but my goodness, my father had a full-time job. So I wish that there were some kind of a little mini training program that could take place, because I'll tell you what my mistake was. My biggest mistake was because I was insecure in what I didn't know, I felt the need to repeat those ridiculous terms that the State Department spokesman would use, you know, these gobbledygook whatever. I thought that I was doing my job by repeating the talking points. This is what the state's meant. So to answer your question, Owen, yes. In the early years that I covered the State Department, I think I did exactly that. Unfortunately, fell into the trap and simply regurgitated what I heard. It wasn't until, and I remember even talking to my dad about this, and I said, you know, here I've come back from Asia, from China, and I have to learn a whole new language. I had to learn Diplo speak. And truly, if you have never really listened to a State Department briefing, you should do it just because if you can actually hear them answer a question directly, I'll give you a prize. They are masters at bobbing and weaving and giving you these vague answers. And I felt like I had to learn a new language. I had to learn how to cut through the Diplo speak. And it took me several years, not only to be able to become fluent in that language, but also to feel comfortable in the sources that I had developed, because I do believe, I mean, I've covered the White House a little, I've covered Congress, I've covered Capitol, I've covered the State Department, I've never covered the Pentagon, but I know from talking with colleagues who do cover the Pentagon that doors are open there and the uniformed men and women there, in many instances, are very happy to talk to the press. Not the case at the State Department. In fact, Madeleine Albright, who was the Secretary of State when I started there, had actually instituted a policy while I was there that you couldn't go above the second floor. Second floor is where the journalists were. First floor is where you enter. You couldn't go above the second floor without an escort. So, you know, obviously you get briefings in different offices, but you were supposed to be escorted by somebody from that office to get there so that you couldn't just drop off in so-and-so's office. So it took me several years to feel like, you know what, if something happens in Africa, if something happens in the Middle East, if something happens in Latin America, I not only have sources within the State Department, but I have diplomatic sources in the community. I had developed sources on Capitol Hill. So I was really able to, and I apologize for using this term, but to triangulate. If the State Department was saying that the Russian government was pleased that the U.S., let's say, was planning to try to get out of the ABM treaty or whatever it was, I would call the Russian embassy. That's not a great example, but I'd call the Russian embassy and say, so the State Department says this. Is that accurate? I mean, there were many instances when I was able to push the story farther because I had sources outside the State Department and because I had sources inside the State Department. And there was also the whole vernacular that I had to learn in reporting and knowing the difference, which I don't know if the average highly intelligent viewer or listener even cares, quite honestly. But there was a difference if I would report, and certainly for the people who were talking to me on, you know, background, which means you don't use their name, on that basis, if it mattered to them, that rather than saying Joe Smith, who's the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, told me XYZ, that I would say a senior State Department official. Okay, so I'm identifying the building versus a senior administration official, which means that person could be anywhere in the government. Chances are it was either the White House, the National Security Council, or the State Department. But there were different degrees of disguise that you could give to, or, you know, cover that you could give to your sources. And, you know, for years it was, do I say a State Department official? Do I say administration? And of course, your source, more often than not, would want to be as anonymous as possible. But if you say an administration official and you're talking about something with the State Department, sometimes it has an extra oomph if you can show that, in fact, you've talked to people in the State Department who've either said, yes, that is the case, or no, that isn't the case. But it was a wonderful learning experience. I mean, I never went to graduate school per se. I didn't pay to go to graduate school, but I felt like I was being paid to be in graduate school. I knew a fair amount about Asia when I went to the State Department, but I knew very little about the rest of the world. And boy, did I have to learn fast, which is why I say that I was in over my head in the beginning. I mean, everything from what was happening in South Asia to what was happening in Indonesia to then there were the East Africa bombings that happened in August of 1998 when Osama bin Laden bombed, had his al-Qaeda terrorists bomb the U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya.
And U.S. bombing in, what, Belgrade in 1999, I think, was in there as well.
Yes, the air war. The air war in which no plane was ever shot down and no one died. I mean, no American died.
One of the interesting things about the way that Washington reporting has changed, and since you mentioned having covered the White House and Congress and the State Department, is think tanks. There are more and more of them in Washington, D.C., and we'll leave aside your personal association with one member of one of the think tanks, that is your husband.
Why leave him aside? He was one of my best sources.
Does that complicate or does that facilitate reporting on these issues?
Oh, I think it facilitates. Absolutely. I mean, in many instances, think tanks are holding stations for whichever party is not in power, and you have a wealth of expertise that previously would only speak to you so long as you didn't quote them by name if they spoke to you at all. And now suddenly they were out of power and doing research and very willing to talk with you on camera. I think that they help certainly to supplement my reporting. And oftentimes these people, even if, let's say, the Republicans were in power and you did have some Republicans who I mean, obviously, there are entire Republican think tanks like AEI and the Heritage Foundation who were talking with people inside the White House and the State Department and other departments who could really help you to understand the thinking. They didn't feel as fettered or restricted in speaking with reporters. And I think that they're a huge resource. I really do. And the other thing that they do, which is really wonderful, is they'll have press conferences, they'll have briefings, and they'll bring together sometimes people from overseas or people from the administration. I mean, President Bush has chosen several think tanks. I think the National Democratic Institute, or was it the Republican Institute, to deliver one of his big speeches about spreading democracy through the Middle East. Frequently, they'll have big name guests who come to speak at their organization.
Do you see yourself going back into journalism at some time? Can you cross that line again?
I would like to think that I would have that option. At the moment, because my son just turned 4, I think I have to kind of see how he does as he gets older. And, you know, if there's an organization, a news organization, probably by that point I'll be so old I won't be able to be on TV anymore. You know, they don't put old women on TV. Well, let's see how old I am. But I think depending upon how old I am and what's happening in my private life, I would like to think that one day I might be back in journalism. I love it.
How good of a grandfather is Ted Koppel?
He is a wonderful entertainer. Can I tell you that? My father, for folks who've never seen this other side of him, does amazing impersonations. Everything from Daffy Duck to Henry Kissinger. You know, he does the range. He is wonderful. He knows how to engage with a child. He loves being a grandfather, and he has now 5 grandchildren, 2 new ones just in the last 6 months. I think it's just getting him to leave the office. You know what I mean? The guy is a workaholic, so it's like, Dad, come over and play with your grandson. But when he's there, he absolutely loves it.
Would you want your son to become a journalist?
You're going to think that this is a cop-out, but what I'm going to say is that I want my son to do whatever makes him happy. So if it's journalism, if it's teaching, if it's being a scientist, an artist, whatever it is, I want him to do whatever fulfills or enriches his soul.
Let me come back with one last question. If you had your career to do over again, since we reviewed a good part of that career, what would you do differently?
Instead of immediately going to work, and my parents may quibble with me because they'll talk about the weeks that I spent at home in between jobs. But I would have taken a year off and I would have traveled the world and I would have just had a backpack and would have gone and really seen all of the places that I still have not seen. I just would have gone and done that. And I think with all due respect to our colleagues in radio, personally, I think that I would have learned faster, smarter, and probably more effectively had I gone into a wire service first rather than radio. And if I had gone overseas and used perhaps my Chinese, my French isn't so terrific, but it was pretty good back then.
Nous pouvons parler français.
Oui, je peux parler français, mais maintenant le français, c'est pas mieux. C'est pas... So I think I would have gone into a wire service where I would have been forced to write fast, figure out my lead, digest all of that information, condense it. I think that's what I probably would have done differently.
That brings us to the conclusion of this conversation. Our guest today has been veteran journalist and now a nonprofit PR person, Andrea Koppel. Andrea, thanks for visiting.
Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure.
To our listeners, we're pleased you joined us, and we close now with more music chosen by Andrea Koppel, Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run. For WFIU, I'm Owen Johnson. It's a
The program you have just heard was recorded in February of 2008. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.